4. On one occasion, just at the time when the first rumours of the emancipation of the serfs were in the air, when all Russia was exulting and making ready for a complete regeneration, Varvara Petrovna was visited by a baron from Petersburg, a man of the highest connections and very closely associated with the new reform. Varvara Petrovna prized such visits highly, as her connections in higher circles had grown weaker and weaker since the death of her husband and had at last ceased altogether. The baron spent an hour drinking tea with her. There was no one else present but Stepan Trofimovitch, whom Varvara Petrovna invited and exhibited. The baron had heard something about him before, or affected to have done so, but paid little attention to him at tea. Stepan Trofimovitch, of course, was incapable of making a social blunder, and his manners were most elegant. Though I believe he was by no means of exalted origin, yet it happened that he had, from earliest childhood, been brought up in a Moscow household, of high rank, and consequently was well-bred. He spoke French like a Parisian. Thus the baron was to have seen from the first glance the sort of people with whom Varvara Petrovna surrounded herself, even in provincial seclusion. But things did not fall out like this. When the baron positively asserted the absolute truth of the rumours of the great reform, which were then only just beginning to be heard, Stepan Trofimovitch could not contain himself, and suddenly shouted, "Hurrah!" and even made some gesticulation indicative of delight. His ejaculation was not overloud and quite polite. His delight was even perhaps premeditated, and his gesture purposely studied before the looking-glass half an hour before tea. But something must have been amiss with it, for the baron permitted himself a faint smile, though he at once, with extraordinary courtesy, put in a phrase concerning the universal and befitting emotion of all Russian hearts in view of the great event. Shortly afterwards he took his leave, and at parting did not forget to hold out two fingers to Stepan Trofimovitch. On returning to the drawing-room, Varvara Petrovna was at first silent for 2 or 3 minutes, and seemed to be looking for something on the table. Then she turned to Stepan Trofimovitch, and with pale face and flashing eyes she hissed in a whisper, "I shall never forgive you for that." Next day she met her friend as though nothing had happened. She never referred to the incident, but 13 years afterwards, at a tragic moment, she recalled it and reproached him with it, and she turned pale, just as she had done 13 years before. Only twice in the course of her life did she say to him, "I shall never forgive you for that." The incident with the baron was the second time, but the first incident was so characteristic and had so much influence on the fate of Stepan Trofimovitch that I venture to refer to that too. It was in 1855, in springtime, in May, just after the news had reached Skvoreshniki of the death of Lieutenant General Gavrogin, a frivolous old gentleman who died of a stomach ailment on the way to the Crimea, where he was hastening to join the army on active service. Varvara Petrovna was left a widow and put on deep mourning. She could not, it is true, deplore his death very deeply, since for the last 4 years she had been completely separated from him, owing to incompatibility of temper, and was giving him an allowance. The lieutenant general himself had nothing but 150 serfs and his pay, besides his position and his connections. All the money and Skvoreshniki belonged to Varvara Petrovna, the only daughter of a very rich contractor. Yet she was shocked by the suddenness of the news, and retired into complete solitude. Stepan Trofimovitch, of course, was always at her side. May was in its full beauty. The evenings were exquisite. The wild cherry was in flower. The two friends walked every evening in the garden, and used to sit till nightfall in the arbour, and pour out their thoughts and feelings to one another. They had poetic moments. Under the influence of the change in her position, Varvara Petrovna talked more than usual. She, as it were, clung to the heart of her friend, and this continued for several evenings. A strange idea suddenly came over Stepan Trofimovitch. Was not the inconsolable widow reckoning upon him, and expecting from him, when her mourning was over, the offer of his hand? A cynical idea, but the very loftiness of a man's nature sometimes increases a disposition to cynical ideas, if only from the many-sidedness of his culture. He began to look more deeply into it, and thought it seemed like it. He pondered, "Her fortune is immense, of course, but Varvara Petrovna certainly could not be called a beauty. She was a tall, yellow, bony woman, with an extremely long face, suggestive of a horse." Stepan Trofimovitch hesitated more and more. He was tortured by doubts. He positively shed tears of indecision once or twice. He wept not infrequently. In the evenings, that is to say, in the arbour, his countenance involuntarily began to express something capricious and ironical, something coquettish and at the same time condescending. This is apt to happen, as it were, by accident, and the more gentlemanly the man, the more noticeable it is. Goodness only knows what one is to think about it. But it's most likely that nothing had begun working in her heart that could have fully justified Stepan Trofimovitch's suspicions. Moreover, she would not have changed her name, Stavrogin, for his name, famous as it was. Perhaps there was nothing in it but the play of femininity on her side, the manifestation of an unconscious feminine yearning so natural in some extremely feminine types. However, I won't answer for it. The depths of the female heart have not been explored to this day. But I must continue. It is to be supposed that she soon inwardly guessed the significance of her friend's strange expression. She was quick and observant, and he was sometimes extremely guileless. But the evenings went on as before, and their conversations were just as poetic and interesting. And behold, on one occasion at nightfall, after the most lively and poetical conversation, they parted affectionately, warmly pressing each other's hands at the steps of the lodge where Stepan Trofimovitch slept. Every summer he used to move into this little lodge, which stood adjoining the huge seigneurial house of Skvoreshniki, almost in the garden. He had only just gone in, and in restless hesitation taken a cigar, and, not having yet lighted it, was standing weary and motionless before the open window, gazing at the light, feathery white clouds gliding around the bright moon, when suddenly a faint rustle made him start and turn round. Varvara Petrovna, whom he had left only 4 minutes earlier, was standing before him again. Her yellow face was almost blue. Her lips were pressed tightly together and twitching at the corners. For 10 full seconds she looked him in the eyes in silence, with a firm, relentless gaze, and suddenly whispered rapidly, "I shall never forgive you for this." When, 10 years later, Stepan Trofimovitch, after closing the doors, told me this melancholy tale in a whisper, he vowed that he had been so petrified on the spot that he had not seen or heard how Varvara Petrovna had disappeared. As she never once afterwards alluded to the incident, and everything went on as though nothing had happened, he was all his life inclined to the idea that it was all an hallucination, a symptom of illness, the more so as he was actually taken ill that very night and was indisposed for a fortnight, which, by the way, cut short the interviews in the arbour. But in spite of his vague theory of hallucination, he seemed every day, all his life, to be expecting the continuation and, so to say, the denouement of this affair. He could not believe that that was the end of it, and if so, he must have looked strangely sometimes at his friend.